Hello and welcome to On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm your host, Hannah Stanley, and today's topic is the impossibly lonely work of policing. Before we jump into that, I do want to remind everybody to take a moment and subscribe to this podcast. You can do that, of course, via iTunes, or if you're on WGNplus.com, you can do that with all of our fine podcasts. Now, on to our topic of the day, the impossibly lonely work of policing. With me is Karen Cook, Director of Adler's Master's in Counseling, specialization in forensic psychology program, but she's also a former police officer herself, and she's here to shed some light on the stressors and trauma that come with the job of policing, as well as some isolating aspects of its culture. Karen, thank you so much for coming in and being with me today. Now, you've said that the nature of police work is inherently stressful and traumatic. Give us a couple of reasons behind that.
Well, first, thank you, Hannah. I'm glad to join you today. I think the vast majority of calls that police officers do respond to, something bad usually happens. And even if you're just there to help, you're interacting with people who are either scared, have some difficulties, or overly stressed, and police officers absorb all of that kind of stress. We're also trained to be alert for any potential danger to ourselves or others, including the people we're responding to their call for service. It's a dangerous job. We need to be ready to defend ourselves any second. For example, a routine traffic stop can turn into a gunfight, and you're not suspecting that, but you become part of it. And that's what I think leads to our hypervigilance, which that's really difficult to turn off. Yeah. Even when you're not on duty. Another thing that adds, I think, to the stress that we experience is our shift work. We're, you know, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365, and that really undermines a lot of relationships. It undermines our sleep, and especially for the newer people, I think they encounter a lot of isolation from family and friends just in getting used to the rigid work schedule. You miss a lot of important family and social events, so it adds, again, to that separation. And in addition, you know, anything that we do that goes to court also requires that not only may have worked all night and then have to appear in court and we're tired, but we'll have to go to work the next night, the next shift, and we're scrutinized in court. Even though our very best interest is, you know, to serve and protect, we're always under scrutiny, and that certainly adds to stress. I think also socially, even when people know you're in law enforcement, they'll often project their frustration on us, and they'll be asking questions about tickets they received or want you to explain to them another officer's decision, and we don't have the facts, so we don't feel comfortable doing that. There's also the weight of knowing that everything you respond to impacts people, and it impacts their community. And so, you know, whether it's just the initial safety of everybody there, or in the long term, the trajectory of having to have someone leave their family, leave their community, go to jail for a decision that they have made. And over time, that just elevated stress can lead to a lot of physical and psychological distress. And then we start to see the baseline of what it's like for law enforcement officers. So it's a challenging profession.
All right. So thank you for giving us such a good overview, broad stroke overview of the stressors that are involved. Tell us a little bit, if you will, about the impact of compounding that stress that's just day-to-day part of the job with trauma that could be a part of the job.
I think trauma is part of the job, and it's inherent, and especially in a big community city like Chicago, there's always an opportunity for something that's traumatic to occur while you're working. We have to deal with, you know, people's lives when they're not in their best condition, gruesome details of our work, you know, looking at bodies, collecting evidence, announcing to others that, you know, someone they love is not returning home. Fatality accidents, especially difficult, are when you see the young children murdered and people just beaten beyond recognition. I mean, it's just the worst of humanity, and you have to absorb that. I think it becomes a burden because we really don't talk about it. You know, you don't want to be going home scaring your families with the details of what you've experienced that day, and so you absorb it. And yes, we might talk among ourselves, but never in terms of, wow, that was really depressing, or I'm so angry. How can people do that to each other? Because then people begin to think, ah, you're getting weak. You know, can I count on you for a backup? What the department will say, and we're always worried about, you know, someone misjudging us is not fit for duty. So I think sometimes we do turn to lesser appropriate coping mechanisms of, you know, joining the crew for a few beers after work or whatever, and then it can become a problem because you're using maladaptive coping means, even though you know they're maladaptive. It just minimizes that psychological burden that you're carrying from the intense trauma that you experience on the job. And I think overall, our sleep disturbance is always there, always, always, always. And so sometimes it is, you know, the sleeping pills to come home to sleep to get ready to go to the next shift. And that isolates us from our family and friends. And it can lead to a lot of divorce and suicide within our field. We view as psychologists that this is really, really an experience of trauma and violence in the workplace, critical incidents that occur in the workplace, and could be vicarious trauma. So the real impact of that, if you have to defend yourself on the street, if you shoot and kill another person, no matter how justified that is, there's a big price to pay, and it's going to affect the rest of their life. I think officers always feel guilt. We're there to serve and protect. We then go under intense scrutiny by our departments and by the public, especially in social media, as you know. And regardless of circumstances, our family is going to be impacted as well as our community because there will be lawsuits filed against us. Mm. And the trauma doesn't go away. PTSD, vicarious trauma, it's there. And it stays with you. And there are very few resources for officers to cope. So for many reasons, this can really ruin an officer's career. And it's sad because we really are dedicated to our communities and to serving our public.
Okay, we're going to, I have so many questions, but let's shift gears just for a moment. Earlier you said that you, the police and the officers don't feel like they can talk to their family, so they keep that within. But they also don't necessarily talk to each other. You alluded a little bit because they don't want to appear weak or unfit, but are there other reasons behind that?
I think when we do speak with one another, it's It does seem supportive in the moment, but it's always negative, and that's not helpful. Negative thinking leads to a lot of other negative thinking. Our families are already worried about our safety, so we don't want to go home and unload on them. And we as fellow officers depend on each other for our safety to get home every day to our families. So if telling another officer, you know, I'm really despondent or I'm feeling, you know, not myself, it's going to undermine the relationship because nobody wants to be the weak link. Nobody wants to be in fear of not being considered one with the team, with the other officers. There are efforts that officers have made with peer support groups and certainly our Chicago Police Survivors, but departments in and of themselves don't really support a lot of that. I think there are movements within the International Chiefs of Police, the Illinois Chiefs of Police, to provide more psychological services, and certainly those of us that have been there, done that, are available and willing. But there's still a stigma about going. It's, you know, how will this impact my career? Will I be sent for a fitness for duty? Will I lose my career? So there's a lot to think about in terms of seeking assistance.
Now that, and that was actually the primary question I wanted to ask before we went into this topic, because, and forgive me for alluding to television and movies, but that it always seems to be very stigmatized. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to have to go to psych. I don't want mm-hmm. to have the eval. I don't want, you know, all they want to do is get through the therapy and the counseling so they can get back to duty.
Yes.
And that is not fake. That's pretty
real.
Accurate.
That's real, yes.
And they don't, frequently they don't seek counseling on their own, privately?
Some will, some won't, but you won't know who does.
Of course, because that would all be very...
It's the confidentiality. That's a critical piece of our work. We're public servants. We're always apparently in the news all the time now, and people make mistakes. But to seek therapy means worrying about your promotion, worrying about your career, worrying about your working alliance with other officers. So should you seek counseling, it's always the concern about confidentiality, this being kept confidential.
So within the ranks, it could be considered as a weakness.
Yes.
Whereas many in the public, in the general public, would consider it a strength. To be seeking assistance and help.
Yes.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Thank you, Karen, so much. Karen Cook, of course, joining me today for this first topic on social health and change. When we come back, we're going to talk with another Adler professor with inside knowledge of Chicago Police Department's administration to explain the difficulty in changing policies that might improve the situation. You are not going to want to miss that. And to prevent you from missing it, make sure that you subscribe at WGNplus.com or right where on your iTunes, anywhere that you download your podcasts. Again, we will be right back on Social Health and Change. I'm Hannah Stanley. We're back for part two of our episode on the impossibly lonely work of policing. I'm Hannah Stanley, the host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. With me currently is Rachel Johnston, director of Adler's Master's in Criminology program. Rachel is also a 13-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department, where she worked as a civilian in the administration. Rachel, before I ask you my first question, I want to remind people that they can always go to WGNplus.com and then link to wherever they download podcasts from and make sure they hit subscribe so all of these great episodes can just populate right there in their devices. But to start with you, Rachel, thank you for being here with me today. I want to first have you describe your position within the Chicago Police Department.
Sure. I worked in the Research and Development Division for 13 years in, you know, progressively more responsible positions. But ultimately, for the last, half or more of my career there, I was the director of the Research and Development Division, which has main responsibility for grants acquisition and management, policy and procedures, which are all the rules that govern the behaviors of people who work for the police department, sworn and civilian, and then research and analysis, which had responsibility for providing data outside the department, for doing internal analysis, evaluating different types of programs like the 10-hour day pilot program and those kinds of things. So we did a number of things there.
All right. So really putting a lot of effort and time in studying how to better our policing.
Yeah, definitely a big part of what we did in the research analysis section was evaluating programs that were either being tested or evaluating assumptions that we had about what was working, what wasn't working.
So tell me what the administration, and this is, of course, within Chicago Police Department, what the administration's attitude is towards police welfare.
Well, I'm sure we've all talked or heard about the thin blue line, which is this sort of idea that police really look out for each other. Mm-hmm. And certainly department changes a lot with every change in leadership because maybe fortunately, maybe unfortunately, a lot of what goes on in the police department is based on the personality of the people in charge.
The superintendent.
Leadership. Yeah.
And they're down.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. The sort of executive staff. By and large, the idea is, yes, we want to take care of police officers, but that does not necessarily translate into providing the most healthy environment for police officers. Sometimes taking care of a police officer means not necessarily doing what's best for that individual officer as a whole person, but rather doing what's best for them to help them keep their job.
All right, which is very old school.
Yes.
Okay. So when we discuss mental health and how mental health is discussed and what those policies are, what are we kind of looking at?
So when I was at the police department, one of the main services that were available to police officers was EAP, Employee Assistance Program. It's a fairly common type of a program where officers could be referred for different kinds of mental health services, for counseling, for marriage support, for financial assistance, problems for gambling, alcoholism, all these different kinds of things. It was there was an option for supervisors to mandate that police officers participated with the EAP program as part of a disciplinary action, but I'm not sure that was frequently used. I think there was a lot of sort of informal counseling that went on in the police department, so it was probably an underutilized resource from my perspective, anyway.
Okay, so that would be when the supervisor would realize that there was a problem with one of his people or her people.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I just was sexist on my own accord, and I didn't mean to be. And they would then therefore mandate that.
Yes.
For that particular person.
Yes.
Who, let's say, has an alcohol issue.
Yes, and there's also another internal division within the police department that had some primary responsibility for coordinating those types of services when it was like a mandated, when it was part of a requirement for discipline. But I think that unit was similarly under-resourced.
Okay, so under-resourced, but did the police officers and the higher-ups value what was being offered as far as mental health care and support?
I think that's a really hard question to answer. I mean, the official position of the police department has always been, as it should be, if you need help, if you have an alcohol problem, if you have a gambling problem, we want to help you get that, the help you need. But in terms of, is there a stigma against using those kinds of services? I mean, there's certainly a stigma in everyday life, regardless of what your job is, for
right.
using those types of services. And I think the police department culture is a very closed culture. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that it was underutilized because the stigma of your colleagues had a big impact on your willingness to seek that kind of help.
I apologized in the first segment on this topic, but I'm going to make the same reference again because so many of us have seen police dramas, television shows, movies where they reference, I don't want to go to psych, or I'm under a psych eval and I want to get out of it. I want to get back on regular duty. That's, in your opinion, you view that as an accurate portrayal? Because they don't want people to view them as.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. Yeah. And I think, again, that's probably fairly typical for our culture, more generally speaking.
Right.
But I definitely feel that. And also with policing, it's such a high risk profession, meaning that the officers have a lot of discretion. And those the things that they choose to do can have significant impact on them and people, on communities. So that's what I mean by high risk. And I think that there's a lot of fear on the part of the police officer that, if I go talk to a counselor, then that's going to come back and haunt me and I won't get that promotion or I won't be allowed to have that responsibility. I'll get put on desk duty, those kinds of things.
And that's if they go through the internal system.
Yes.
Okay. From a policy perspective, what is holding back the Chicago Police Department from improving what they're offering in the mental health space?
It's hard for me to answer that because I'm not sure that what they are offering is or isn't adequate. I think the best thing that they could do would be to really try to change the culture around what it means
reduce the stigma.
Yes.
Eliminate the stigma.
Yeah. And what it means to take care of each other. Like, I think it would be very important for at every level of the organization to say helping your friend to get home without driving drunk is more important than anything else you can do for that individual, even if they feel that, you're hurting them in the short run.
Or admitting that you're having some trauma and saying it's okay and we can get you help.
Yes.
Based on an incident.
Yes.
Okay. Which would be delightfully healthy in the regular world.
Yes.
Outside of policing. So everybody, let's just make that the new go-to. But... Now, personally, what cultural aspects do you think need to change to make an improvement in the broad stroke mental health of our officers?
I feel that that probably, again, I mean, same answer to what I just gave, that it's not about just saying these resources are available. It's about changing the culture about stigma, but also really about what it means to be well and what it means to take care of your colleagues. It's a long process to change culture in any way. And policing is maybe a tougher nut to crack than other types of organizations. And in Chicago in particular, we change the leadership a lot, very often. And I think that's also part of the problem. So it would be great to have more long-term, consistent, and applied messages being sent about what it means to take care of each other and what it means to be well.
Is this, to your knowledge, and I understand that your experiences with CPD, but is this a program that other departments utilize where they have a focus on good mental health?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't say that there's necessarily even a focus on it in Chicago, just that I know all departments have to have something available, but I don't know to what extent it's being utilized, encouraged, emphasized.
But to some degree, that's almost a legal concern. Like we have
Absolutely.
To we have it.
Absolutely.
They have access to it.
That's right.
Okay. So it's a CYA for most at the very basic level, it's a CYA. They just want to cover themselves legally because if somebody ever were to take legal action against the police department, they can say, well, it's available.
Yeah.
It's available to everybody.
That's right.
Okay. But at this point, the officers need to either ask for help or be mandated to get it for whatever they're suffering through, working
yes.
through.
And I believe that the EAP program, which is the voluntary program, is all outside referrals, which is probably a good thing if people were able to take advantage of it. But again, there has to be a trust on the part of the police officers that being sent outside the department won't result in their secrets coming out, which is, you know, I did that in quotes, air quotes, their secrets.
You actually could hear them in your voice, so that's okay. That worked out well.
I think there is a great deal of mistrust among both the police and the community. And so I feel that while it could be significantly beneficial to have outside resources for mental health issues for the police department, given, of course, limited resources, they can't provide all those resources, you know, high quality mental health resources within the department, right? So they have to be provided outside. But even so, I feel that that's probably it could be seen as being threatening to police officers.
Okay, that's very interesting. Joining me right now, pardon me, is Rachel Johnston, director of Adler's Master's in Criminology program and a 13-year veteran in the Chicago Police Department, where you worked as a civilian in the administration, bringing a unique view to our conversation. I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. This is part two of our topic, the impossibly lonely work of policing. If you missed our first segment, I do invite you to go back and take a listen, because it's incredibly fascinating. And then coming up, we have a retired police officer talking about his traumatic experience and how he navigated through what we've been talking about, which is EAP. And that's going to be incredibly interesting. So make sure you hit subscribe on this podcast if you would. When change, and you've referenced a couple of times, and currently we're in the middle of a superintendent change as well here in the Chicago Police Department, but that's a big change that's going to happen quickly. We're in between right now, so we're kind of like status quo. But normal change, and I'll do air quotes for normal, but that's a huge bureaucracy, the Chicago Police Department. So how does change happen and go through? And not necessarily the mental health care stigma, but I mean, just change in general.
That is a huge question. And I don't think there is, you know, an answer that's been, you know, empirically demonstrated that this is what's going to work here, that's what's going to work there. But I can comfortably say that a lot of it has to do with leadership. And I definitely think that there has to be consistency because culture change is so time consuming. It takes a really long time to do it. So
does it seem to be generational? Like when we have, especially in the Chicago Police Department, where we have multiple decades of officers. So is it something that when the old guys, quote unquote, when they retire, it becomes easier to get that change? Or is it something where they say, no, this is what we're doing and this is going to go through the ranks and everybody respects that?
I absolutely think that if we just, you know, set the timer now and waited 20 years, that things would be a lot different. You know, the current generation of young people are significantly different than, you know, my parents' generation. So, certainly, I mean, when I started at the police department, there was a lot of kind of honeys and babies, right? And after
female working in Chicago police department, yeah.
And after by the time I left, that was by and large gone. When I started, lots of police officers didn't use computers, and again, by and large, that's gone. So significant things like that do change over time. But that being said, we don't want to wait 20 years. We
right,
don't want to
no.
just hope that, you know, the attitudes that are sort of natural to our young people aren't, you know, killed as they enter the police department as young recruits, which, of course, is part of it. There's mm-hmm. this perception that young police officers, they start on the job and they go through the academy and they learn to do things in the way that has been validated and has been carefully planned. And then the second that they get onto the street, that they're told by veteran officers, forget everything you learned in the academy. That's book learning. Yeah, exactly. So that's, you know, that's definitely part of the problem. So we really do have to change the attitudes of individuals. So that's a really hard question, right? So I feel that in the past, some of these innovators in policing, maybe like Bill Bratton, that they have been very successful at changing the culture at the top of the department, which is really important. But in a profession like policing, where you do have such wide discretion, and I don't know of any department that has what you would call necessarily adequate supervision, right? You've got, even if you've got like a 7-to-1 ratio between a frontline officer and a sergeant, they're in completely different geographies, right? So it's really hard to do supervision where you really know exactly what all your officers are doing all the time.
Right. And at some point you've got one or two in a car together.
Exactly.
Dealing with things we're not necessarily aware of.
Right.
Because how could we be?
Right. Exactly. And maybe, you know, technology may help us in this respect, but I am also at the same time leery of sort of like trying to use a technological solution for everything. We don't want to just put everyone under surveillance so we knew absolutely what everybody's doing it all the time. But, you know, that's certainly a, something that could happen over time. But that going back to what I started to say, the leadership at the top is going to have, if it's the right type of leader, the ability to really impact change at the top of the organization. So the question really is, well, how do you get it down to mm-hmm. the bottom? Because you're not having direct supervision of your officers most of the time. And it's hard to change attitudes. And so it really is going to be about winning the hearts and minds. And that's going to take a really long time and a really consistent message. It's something that's delivered by a leader that individuals in the organization trust, that, you know, that their peers are able to trust them as well and sort of build from the bottom. It's a great question, but it can be done. It has been done. I wish I could write down the formula, but I don't know what it is.
So for the most part, change occurs slowly. However, if you get the right leader and the right message and the right spin on that message to your people, it'll trickle down faster.
Yeah, and I think a really important part in policing culture is the trust. The individuals that are putting themselves on the line when they go on the streets every day that aren't closely supervised, they need to feel that the people at the top care about what they're doing and will protect them. And so there has to be that trust developed between the leadership and the individuals. And that's going to make it easier for those types of messages, those cultural messages, to be absorbed within the ranks. But the question is, how do you do that? You know, you're just waiting for an opportunity to get the backs of police officers. Like you're waiting for something to happen. I don't know. It's a big question.
All right. So here's an even bigger one. because we are all affected in some manner or another by our police force in whatever city you happen to be in, how can the public influence this decision? Do we have any say in the fact that we want our police officers to be encouraged to get mental health care or whatever that change might be?
That's a great question. There's different structures. Like in Los Angeles, I think the police chief can only be there for 10 years, right? So that's like a term limit for policing. That would not have made any difference in Chicago at all because we have so much more
turnover.
We
rarely get to 10 years, yes.
Yeah, and historically in L.A., before Bill Bratton came, I think there was a lot of independence. So the police department, and this is the time when they had a lot of scandals in policing, right? So, right, there was this independence that the police department really could do whatever they want. And in Chicago, you know, it's much different. But there's really one person in charge in the police office of the police department in Chicago, and that's the mayor. Mm-hmm. In Chicago specifically, like the way to get influence is to, you know, deliver your message
via your mayor.
Yeah, or to your police chief or, you know, whomever. But I don't know that there's a more sort of direct, easier, faster, impactful way of doing that. I haven't seen a model where, the community actually has a say in decision making, but that's certainly possible. Like, for example, creating policy at the police department, there was an informal rule against allowing community input into the policy making decisions. But that's something that could change and has been slowly changing over time. So that's a way that I think when the police department does that, when they take input willingly from the communities, they learn a lot. There's a lot of stuff that they don't know, that they're not thinking about, that's not part of their decision-making process, and that when their messages do come from communities in a constructive way that the police are open to, that can be impactful on what the police are doing. And maybe that could be built into the process of how work gets done in policing.
So maybe in smaller towns, it would be easier to make these changes. We're very large and bureaucratic here.
Yes.
In the city of Chicago. But perhaps a town hall every once in a while, folks, that would be awesome. Thank you, Rachel, so much for your time and your knowledge and what you brought to this conversation. Please, listeners, stay tuned for part three. As I mentioned, we're going to talk with a retired Chicago Police Department about his traumatic experience and how he navigated through the mental health care system and the employee assistance program, and what he's doing to help others. Again, please hit subscribe for On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm your host, Hannah Stanley, and I'll talk to you in just a minute. Welcome back to On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I am Hannah Stanley, and this is part three of our episode of The Impossibly Lonely Work of Policing. I'm joined today with Brian Warner, an 18-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department and founder of the organization Chicago Police Survivors. Before we chat with Brian, I want to remind you to make sure to subscribe to our podcast on Social Health and Change. You can do that via the WGN Plus app, or you can do that anywhere you download your podcast. Just hit subscribe and they will populate automatically, and you won't miss an episode. Now, Brian, thank you, of course, for coming in and sitting and talking with me. Of course. Now, you were medically retired from the department. Can you lead us through the events that led to that, please?
First of all, thank you for using that terminology. That's something the medically retired. That's something that the department does not use. They consider me disabled. Which I don't feel disabled.
You don't look it.
No, and even officers who I talk to, I mean, my injury is psychological, so I walk into a room, and I'm 6'3", 200 pounds. I look healthy. I am healthy, but I have emotional scars. So people don't understand, oh, you're on disability. Are you trying to work the system? What is it that just from that category alone, from that labeling, and even officers who have catastrophic injuries or in wheelchairs are still productive members, and they feel a stigma to being labeled as disabled as well. And that's one of the simple things I've asked the department to do, print up a new ID, put a new label on it. I think it's I don't want to sound politically correct again because that term is overused, but I think just from an emotional standpoint, it would be something that would go a long way.
To say medically retired.
Medically retired opposed to disabled.
Okay. And in the military, is that...
The military, I believe, uses that term.
Because so much of the of police work and how it's structured is based on military.
It is. And unfortunately, the PTSD, the military, it's been around forever. Post-traumatic stress has been around forever. It was in the Civil War. It was called battle fatigue. It was in World War II. It was called shell shock. It's been around forever. Post-traumatic stress is the latest term they use for it. And the military is just only starting addressing it 10 years ago, possibly. And then the local municipality, Chicago and New York and all the other places will jump on board. But they take their cue from the military. So if the military is just catching up, we're many, many years behind.
Mm. All right. Considering what we've just talked about, PTSD, the military is now starting to offer tremendous amounts of help. Lots of research going into this. Were you offered help to cope with yours?
Unfortunately, the resources we had when I went through my incident in 2011, I was involved in a shooting where I was shot in the line of duty, returning fire, killing the offender who shot me. My partner and I were both mandated to go into one session at our Chicago Police Employee Assistance.
That's mandated for one.
One. You're 3 days off to take time to figure out what happened, and then one session is all that's required. I've tried to broaden that. I've gone to the department and asking them to advance on it. Dr. Cook talked about the National Chiefs of Police. They have a protocol for officer-involved shootings. We're not reinventing the wheel. All I'm asking is that we implement some of these things. Most recently, because of the whole high-profile shootings, they've taken officers off the street for 30 days. That's a step in the right direction. That's one of the things we've been asking for in the survivors group, is that you take them off, but monitor them, you know, for that 30 days. Don't just take them off and make them feel as if they're being disciplined. They're already feeling vulnerable enough because they've taken a life. They're being scrutinized in the media. They're being scrutinized by the politicians, being scrutinized by everybody, people who don't even have the facts. This officer's reeling enough. I mean, it's a human being who's already just taken another human being's life. There's no way you can punish him more than he's already he or she's already punishing themselves.
Because if there isn't scrutiny, if there isn't the media coverage, if it's very understandable, everybody gets it, they're still dealing with the trauma of what they of those actions.
Correct. And said it was a justified shooting. Obviously, the person shot me first, but it could have went a totally different direction based on the media. The day of the shooting that occurred was 5 o'clock in the evening. The media reached out to one of the family members of the person I was in a shootout with. And that evening, the family member said something to the effect, "Doesn't surprise me. My brother was mentally ill. He was off his meds. He was self-medicating. We had to move our mother away from him because he was stealing her goods to buy his drugs." And just tells the facts. The next day, that same person is on TV because the lawyers reached out to him, crying, literally crying, saying if the police would have done their job, if they would have done this, would have done that, and changing all the facts altogether. So by the grace of God, and the media wasn't blowing in a direction where there was another high-profile case, I could be one of these officers that are being thrown to the wolves today.
Okay, so when you went to your one mandated appointment.
Correct.
And then you... Tell me what was next. Did you go on to desk duty? Did you find someone on your own?
No, there was no requirement for desk duty. My partner and I returned to work. I was actually had a schedule for a Lowell vacation. I went on that 2-week vacation. In the meantime, my partner went to work every day. Then when I returned from my 2-week vacation, the two of us went to the counseling session together. We talked to the woman for an hour or so. Our session ended. I knew I needed more help. I grabbed her card. I went back a handful of times, didn't feel as if I was getting the my needs filled. Some things happened that didn't really, I lost confidence in that system.
In the support system.
In that support system,
okay.
Yes. So I stopped going there, and I just blew in the wind for several months, just self-medicating, drinking too much, and doing things that were I thought were cries for help, hoping that somebody may notice and say, what is it that you need? That went on for several months, and then my partner retired, and the partner who I was in the critical incident with, and then things really went south.
Now, he retired based on the time to retire.
Right. He'd already planned on retirement before our shooting. He was coming of the age where he was going to be mandatory retired anyway. He was going to leave the department. It had nothing to do with the shooting. It wasn't the...
But your stability, your base,
right.
Was now crumbling.
It was, because that person who... had the common interest or the common theme of what had happened to us.
You both got it.
Right.
Okay. So then you, what was the next step? He retired. You were self-medicating. You weren't getting the support you felt you needed.
Right.
And you were going through the system the way it is structured currently. What did you do next?
I talked to a few bosses who direct me back to the EAP. I gave the EAP a second chance. Again, they were helpful. They were empathetic, but nothing. I hadn't even been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress yet. I'm just going through the motions.
And how long is this? 6 months? Nine months?
We're 6 months out now, okay. 8 months out. It was almost a full year that I found my own doctor through a friend who recommended this doctor who knows police culture, who knows post-traumatic stress, who actually gave me a written test and analyzed me. Through counseling, you know, through a session, and finally diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress. And once that happened, we started treating it. I've said this to many people. I'm thoroughly convinced had this been dealt with in a more timely fashion and addressed sooner instead of festering inside of me, I could have returned to work faster and more healthy for everybody, more healthy for myself, more healthy for the citizens, more healthy for my fellow officers. So for our department not to have a more thorough and more direct counseling session is a disservice to everybody.
And to have someone who's already trained, already has a lot of experience, it makes sense financially to get you the support you need and put you back on the street.
And that's one of the economic factors that I brought up to them. I said, you can pay in a lawsuit further down the line because this person is frustrated and they're coming to work stressed out every day because of their critical incident. And it doesn't even have to be a shooting. It doesn't even have to be a car accident or anything, all the other horrific things. Just the cumulative things we do every day. I mean, picking up dead babies, the elderly, those are the biggest effects on us. But at some point, even going to these crime scenes and the gangbangers and everybody else shot, it's going to take its toll on you.
Certainly.
Unfortunately, people think that officers are robots. They think because you put a uniform on somebody and hang a badge and a gun on the badge on their chest and a gun on their hip, they're immune to all these stressors. It's just simply not true. And then for people to vilify the police officers when they do their job without even knowing the facts is just an added stressor that's not needed at all.
All right. So you at this point in the story, you've sought counseling on your own. Did you take yourself off of duty?
I did. One day I came to work. I went directly to our union, drove to our union hall on Washington Boulevard, walked in there, told them what was happening. They put me in reoccurrence of IOD. Excuse me.
Take your time.
That was probably the most difficult part of it, to walk in there and admit that I was having an issue.
Because you felt weakness.
Not necessarily weakness, but I knew I needed the help and I wasn't getting it. I was frustrated because I'm like, okay, finally. They're like, okay, we're putting on reoccurrence of IOD, injured on duty from the original shooting. And this is said probably 9 months later. So I go to our medical section. And again, I have to take a step back. I do not want to beat up the department too badly. But because they do offer our survivors, they allow us to go talk to the recruits and trying to help change his culture. They do allow us to go to the Officer Involved Shooting class that's once a month at the academy and forge a relationship with these.
So they've developed some outlets.
They have.
We're getting there.
But I think... Dr. Cook, again, mentioned EAP. And
Dr. Cook, you've referenced twice. She was in our first segment. If you weren't able to listen to it, I invite you to take a listen.
She mentions a lot of things. There's lots of groups, the survivors, our chaplain's ministry, our EAP. They all are great tools. But my suggestion to the department was let's all get together, look at the National Chiefs of Police outline, and all find our role in this so each officer has an outlet. Society in general, even non-police population, there's a stigma to mental health.
Right.
People do not want to admit that their loved one is suffering from any mental illness or that they're stressed out or that there's PTSD. People are stigmatized by it.
And people themselves don't want to admit it.
Correct.
If they even realize what's going on, which is a, I guess, a greater challenge. So the fact that you were aware of this, took action, and then walked into your peers and said, I'm seeking help, and I need to be off the streets.
Right. And I did that, and it was a relief because they were like, okay, go to the medical section. We have a medical section at our headquarters at 35th Street. and they are the clearinghouse. If you have any injury, physical injury related to your job, you go there and they help you find the doctors within their program to get you the help you need. She said, the woman who was helping me there said, well, I talked to the people at the union, and it sounds as if you have post-traumatic stress. At that point, I heard the term, wasn't familiar enough with it, but agreed with her. Said, mm-hmm. That's probably a good place to start. She said, well, what doctor would you like to see? I said, well, isn't that your job? I said, I thought you were the medical section. Aren't you going to direct me to a doctor? She started Googling doctors. That's when I lost confidence once again. I couldn't believe
they didn't even have a Rolodex.
They didn't have a group of doctors. And I talked to another officer who was in a shooting shortly after mine. They tried to send him to a pediatric psychiatrist. And they gave him the number. They just wanted to get him out of the office and send him away. And so he pulled out a cell phone and called up this number that they gave him before he left the office and said, hey, I'm a 40-year-old policeman involved in some trauma. And they're like, sorry, we can't help you.
No, but there would be doctors who have that specialization.
I've been told that they've added these doctors to the list and they've vetted doctors and they have them. I've offered. I said, can you please give them to me so we can post them on our website so people that may not be comfortable going through the EAP. There's officers that pay out of pocket. The doctors that we vetted say that the officers know they need help. We've had a huge influx in the last couple months because these officers are beaten. They're just reeling from the effects of all the police bashing.
Sure.
And if you look at the facts, police shootings in Chicago are down 40%. The police are not shooting unarmed black men to the rate that some people make you believe.
Or anybody in general. All right. So let's we're gonna jump back again. Now you've gone through therapy for a year.
The director of our EAP at that time was getting ready to retire. Unfortunately, I think she was a little bit checked out. She saw her retirement date coming and maybe wasn't as thorough with her job. But I was the squeaky wheel. Mm-hmm. I knew that I needed help. I knew that I couldn't be the only officer out there that needed help. I said, please make me the poster boy for post-traumatic stress. I will go to roll calls. I will go do videos. I will do anything the department needs, but we need to address this problem.
Yeah, you've already owned it publicly.
Right. I've owned it.
You might as well.
Know.
Yeah.
And they refused that. At this point, the woman from the AP does find another doctor for me. So I'm seeing two doctors, one at Rush Hospital, who's written in journals for post-traumatic stress, has a contract with the FBI, who's right up the road on mm-hmm. Roosevelt Road. He does their debriefings for their officers after critical incidents. He said he had approached the city many years ago saying, you probably have 25 to 30% of your officers have some form of post-traumatic stress. Maybe you want to start addressing this.
Which seems like it would be pretty consistent in at least larger town police forces.
Correct. It's everywhere in policing, but more so in a big city. Correct.
Yeah. When you come back to work, after you've been seeing counselors and going through therapy, what happened at this point?
I was off almost a full year. I was coming up to a no-paid status. If I don't, I have two choices. I can ask for disability or I can come back to work. My choice was to come back to work. We put together, my doctors and I put together a protocol based on the National Chiefs of Police.
You're a cop.
Right.
That's what you do.
Right. We put together a protocol saying this is what the National Chiefs slowly implemented me back in mm-hmm. by putting me on desk duty, monitoring me. If I'm being short with somebody who's coming in to make a simple report and I'm, you know, being stressed out and not treating that person well, probably not quite ready to go on the street. So that's one of the simple things. Then if you monitor that person for a couple weeks as they're on the desk, then you say, okay, they're ready to go hit the street. Put them with a veteran officer who knows that their history. You don't just throw them to somebody and say, hey, you know, they have to know that this person was involved in the shooting. We're implementing back on the street. Are you willing to work with this officer?
Right.
And there are plenty of officers out there who would do it. But you need to let them know so that they're looking for this thing. Am I overreacting? Am I underreacting? Am I acting appropriately?
Mm-hmm.
Am I escalating situations? Those are the type of things that you need to monitor. If you do these things and you help the officer and continuous, not just a one-time trip to EAP, anybody can go through a doctor and say, no, I'm good, thank you, I'm leaving.
Especially if you're trying to get back on the street.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So if it's mandatory that you go immediately after your critical incident, your shooting, then 6 months, then a year, then maybe the things that you told them weren't you weren't experienced, The second time, you're a little more comfortable with that doctor, and you're saying, you know what, I am still having trouble sleeping. I am having the flashbacks. I am short-tempered. All my relationships are failing because I'm so stressed out. Policing is if nothing else, please take away from this that police officers are human beings. We're not robots. There's a most recent high-profile case where the attorney said something to the effect, the attorney for the offender shot by the police said something to the effect, if the police officer can't handle doing that, he shouldn't be a police officer. My question to him, or my statement back to him, would be careful what you wish for. If you want a department full of members who can pull a trigger and shoot somebody and not have any feelings about that, be careful what you wish for, because I don't think anybody wants that.
We don't need non-empathetic people policing.
And officers are. We take this job to help people. I can guarantee you, if you go into the police academy right now, if there's a class starting today and you say, why did you take this job? Resounding, I took this job to help people. And it's difficult to go and help people every day when the communities a lot of times don't want your help, because you've gone in there. The first experience with a police officer is there's a domestic in the house. The police officer comes. Mommy and daddy are fighting. One of them two has to go to jail. The officer arrests one of them. Now what's that child's impression of police officers?
Right. They take
They're bad. They
away.
Take away my mom or dad. When the mom or dad come back from jail 2 days later or 3 days later after cooling off period, and they come back in that house, do they have that conversation with them saying, you know what? Mommy and daddy had made a mistake. Daddy was wrong. The police officer did his job. No.
No, they want to be.
Right. So now you have another generation tainted and skewed thinking the police are bad. We need ambassadors. We have wonderful, wonderful athletes in the city. We have wonderful actors and people that officer friendly with an ambassador of a celebrity. That the kids would be excited to see a celebrity walk in a room and then the celebrity say, this is my friend, a police officer. And a police officer would tell them what they do and say, we're here to help you. It's a simple, simple thing.
This is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm Hannah Stanley, and currently we are talking with Brian Warner, 18-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department, and founder of the organization Chicago Police Survivors. At this point in the story, Brian, you have been going through counseling for over a year, and now you are being brought back. You've put together a plan with your doctors to work your way back into daily
full-time
work. At some point, you were then taken off the force. Tell me how this happened.
It still dumbfounds me. When I first walked in there and asked for help, had they said, Brian, we're so glad that you asked for the help. In the meantime, while getting your help, here's a temporary ID. So if you need to go to the police station for anything or stop in to use the facilities, the workout room or something in another police station other than your own where people don't recognize you, you have that afforded
access,
to you.
Access, yeah.
Right. So, but in the meantime, get yourself better. Don't take any police action. As difficult as that would have been to hand over my badge and my ID that I carried with me for almost 20 years, I would have been able to do it. But to ask for the help and not be able to receive it from the department, then go out and seek it on my own and go through the trials and tribulation of doctors and finding the person that can help me. And then when that person and I put together a plan to bring me back, that's when they call psych you. Mm-hmm. They bring me upstairs at headquarters, take my badge, my ID away. They strip me of my police powers and say, well, that's the way we do it. I said, what's the sense? What is the reasoning behind this?
And so you had your badge and your ID while you were off duty.
And without incident.
So then when you come back, then they take it away.
Correct.
Okay. And all right. So obviously I can only assume that was devastating.
It was. And my
because
doctor,
you're like, wait, I've been doing work to make this better.
Right. And I said that all those same things to the person who was taking my badge away. And I said, you are part of the problem. I said, if you can't recognize how this is affecting officers, you should be ashamed of yourself. I said those very words to him. I said, we need to treat our officers better. I said, the department's done some great things. Put another helicopter in the air, put more boats on the water, built new police stations, given us new SUVs, more firepower in our rifles. What have they done for the individuals who are doing all those things? Your most important asset is your officer. You need to have their well-being at their well-being has to be the number one priority, and unfortunately, it's not.
Okay, so based on this experience, you channeled it in an incredibly excellent way, where you organized and founded Chicago Police Survivors. Tell me about that organization.
I have to give credit to Steven Tyler, who's an officer who was involved in a shooting many years ago, and he initially started the group. So I resurrected it. I reached out to Steve, and he told me what their goals were at the time. And same thing, when he went through his critical incident, he was involved in a shooting, almost died from his injuries. When he was coming back to work, he was, you know, having all these emotions and all these stressors, and he had nowhere to turn to. So he started the group originally, and then it went by the wayside when Phil Klein and the Police Memorial came around. They couldn't compete with them financially and for the recognition. So the natural process was to approach Phil and go under his umbrella, the memorial, and that's who currently sponsors us. They support our website. They support our phone that I carry with me 24 hours. We send out mailings to officers after their critical incidents, introducing ourselves and letting them know the resources we have for them and their families. I said, we also go to the police academy. That's the number one thing we're trying to do, is get to the academy before these officers get on the street and tell them the current environment in policing is to try and laugh it off and macabre, you know, police humor, which only will take you so far, or to go have a couple beers and try and forget about it. At some point, these, you know, things that you see every day, I said, even if you never get to the point, but I hope you never get to the point where you have to be involved in a shooting or take a life or be shot at. But even the just day-to-day things are going to stress you out. And it's in your best interest to seek the help and ask for the help, because nobody's going to ask you, hey, how you doing after seeing those three dead bodies? As most recent as a couple weeks ago when that whole family was killed mm-hmm. in their home. Seven victims. Every single officer that went there was affected, some differently than others. But I do have hope, because I over the weekend I did hear that one of the bosses had the courage to go there and set up a meeting with EAP, our employee assistants, and those officers, and have them go in there and talk about their experience there and try and get some. So we are making strides, but we're a long way away.
We're seeing a shift in culture.
We are.
It's tiny.
Right. But the number one thing, or it's a three-prong system that I've been asking for since I began this. Roll call training, saying, one, have one of our survivors who are open to telling their stories, go to roll call and say, this is the horrific thing that happened to me. This is how I dealt with it. It wasn't a healthy way, but now we have resources for you to get there. So you have the story of somebody who's been through a critical incident. Secondly, you have a clinician, a doctor, somebody from EAP who's been vetted, that knows police culture, that's not going to get an officer jammed up and have their FOID card taken away, have them, you know, stripped of their police powers and set them back even further in their
recovery. Handle it with some dignity.
Right. Okay. Handle it with some dignity. And thirdly, and probably most important, is an administrator, commander or above, from the department to say, we want you to ask for this help. We are not going to discipline you for asking for this help. It is in your best interest and our best interest, everyone's best interest, the community, the police department, your families, yours. Everybody's going to gain by you being a healthier, more productive employee. So please ask for this help. They're paying for it one way or the other.
Right. Yeah,
pay up front and have a more productive, happy employee, or pay in the long run because this officer is so stressed out, does something silly, and there's a lawsuit.
And long term, and we've referred briefly to the stigma of mental health and the need for
and it's tenfold,
for healthcare.
It's tenfold in policing, because we are macho. We are providers. We are the fixers. We are the healers. And for us to have to ask for help, it's very, very difficult.
But it might then, if it does become the culture where help is the norm,
sure.
And understanding that people need to work through things,
right.
This might change the regular general population stigma.
Sure. And there's other departments, San Diego, Texas, places where there's military bases where these military people transition into law enforcement. They know they're great people because they can be trained. They dedicated to their country. They have a great background, but they may be carrying a little bit of baggage because of the things they saw while serving. And they address that. As they introduce them into the police department, they say, okay, are you healthy enough? Have you, you know, dealt with the things you saw in combat? If they say yes, then they you know, cycle them into the police department and continually monitor them. And they're existing officers who have never had military experience. They recognize it. and they're proactive.
Because they see it amongst themselves, and they also are used to, there's a norm of getting treatment or working through this that is different. Tell me how you got involved with Adler University.
Dr. Cook, how did we finally, she reached out to me because the survivors group was having one of our events, and she, now they give us a couple of their interns each time we do our event, and they help us with our website. I'm not technically savvy at all, and they do a great job updating our website and doing all a lot of putting together programs for us that we can introduce to our officers, PowerPoint presentations that we can use at the academy. It's just a great relationship. And that's what I said. Adler's been a great resource for the survivors group. Phil Klein in a police memorial has been a great resource financially. Father Dan in our police chaplains ministry. The folks of the AP with limited resources do a great job. But I said we need to combine the efforts and really put forth that combined effort into solving this problem. And I don't, like I said, the programs are out there. It's just implementing them and doing the right thing for our officers and for our community. A healthier officer is going to be a much better servant of the community.
Well, I will say most frequently when I talk to someone in the service or when I talk to a police officer, fire department, I always thank them for their work and for their bravery. And in this incident, I have to say thank you for your bravery and what you're doing now, because this is something that is it would be challenging for many people to come forward and take that stand and say,
well,
I need
you.
Help, and others might also.
I would hope that everybody listening today takes that message as well. I think after 9/11, of my 18 years in the police department, it was only probably a week after 9/11 did we see that recognition, because they saw what those police and fire officers, the first responders, did when that horrific thing was going on. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, if something happens here, these are going to people that have been doing it for us.
Absolutely.
So they were shaking your hand, buying you a coffee. If you had lunch, you had a sandwich. You'd go to pay your bill and say, oh, that person, you know, left already. They don't want your thanks, but they bought you a sandwich. We're the same police officers.
And you didn't get into it for
right.
that.
No. I said, we're the same police officers. We're doing the same things every day. But there's a small minority, and I'm not sure what the motivation is other than money to bash the police and vilify us. We're out there every day. We respond to hundreds and hundreds of jobs, whether it be domestic, whether it be negotiating a two neighbors quarreling, a disturbance in the park. We're engaging the community without incident, solving these problems and doing the best we can with it. So when we're scrutinized for the handful of events and just bashed by the politicians, go on TV saying that my police department's corrupt, they're racist, and then try and show up to a roll call with a couple pizzas and say, oh, don't worry, guys, you're doing a great job. We can't have that. You need to be united and say our police have issues. We have our situations. We can certainly do more training. But our society and our culture have bigger issues that we need to all work together to solve, because we cannot keep continuing bashing and vilifying the police and making them the scapegoat for all these issues.
All right. Brian, thank you, one, again, for your work and for your service, and also for being here today and sharing your story. Brian Warner, 18-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department and founder of the organization Chicago Police Survivors. That is going to conclude this episode on social health and change brought to you by Adler University. Don't forget to go to iTunes, search Adler University, and find and subscribe to this podcast. And join us next week for the sex episode. Again, I'm Hannah Stanley. Thanks so much for listening.